Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
Word to your moms, I came to drop bombs.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com for show notes, new subscriber geography trivia, theme song lyrics, or to just leave comments. Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast. And get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project. And here's Bert.
I wasn't totally satisfied or excited by the world that they gave me. They said, hey,
yeah,
you know, you'll go to school, you'll fill out these things, you'll get on this bus. I just thought all that kind of sucked. So I did my own thing.
Yeah, I used to do these little narcissistic comics of myself as a superhero.
Now we're getting into it.
It was just named Super Andrew. And like literally it was just a guy who looked like Superman, but he had a cape and it had an A on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had Super Dave.
And I had Super Kid, which I wrote and won the Young Authors Contest in first grade. And I even drew pictures and then just cut out photos of my head and pasted them on.
Oh, wow. That's an extra step.
Yeah.
So is this something everybody does or are we weird?
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Today is June 25th. It's early in the morning. The sun is shining. The birds are chirping. And this is the last thing on my to-do list before I drive up to Lancaster, New Hampshire for the Porcupine Freedom Festival. I'm speaking on Saturday at 2 p.m. I'm going to be giving a speech called How to Explain the History and Intentions of the Government Schooling System and to Sell Home Education to Ordinary People Without Sounding Like a Lunatic. Many of you might be saying you need to work on your titles, Brett. So I'm still editing the fifth part in the Adverse Childhood Experiences and Resilience series. I'm just, you know, looking carefully through Pete Gerlach's videos to find the best clip for that show. And that should be along early next week. In the meantime, I would say this is optional listening. A discussion about the creative process, about childhood fantasy, baseball, movies, video games, lepofuology. This is a loose one. But I really enjoyed this conversation, and I thought I would include it here. For those of you who maybe need a break from the pretty heavy stuff we've been delivering lately, that would certainly be understandable. So, maybe I'll see you at Porkfest. I want to thank the audience for suggesting that speech topic. I'll also be on a panel at 11 a.m. Saturday, led by Bob Bowden. He was the guy who made that Cartel movie about the New Jersey teachers unions. And supposedly, I'm going to be participating in a roast emceed by Adam Kokesh at midnight Sunday morning. So those are my events. And I wanted to tell you about one more thing quickly here. I was up there earlier in the week. I went up Sunday evening to do the Freedom Fiends Monday morning at 1 a.m. The show is from 1 to 3 a.m. And we had a fantastic time doing the show. It was me, Derek J., M.K. Lords, and Davi Barker, who you're going to hear in this podcast today. After the show was over, I said, guys, that was such a good time. Do you want to do an after show? And everybody said yes. So we started the after show at 3:30 in the morning. Now, you know me. I'm tracking my sleep. I've got an app, SleepBot. I'm trying to get my 8 every night. But this was a special event. There was just something magical in the air that night. So we started recording at 3:30. We were kicked out of the studio by the news guy at 8 a.m. So there was a 4.5-hour after show. After this, the four of us, we walked outside the media room and we said, it doesn't even feel right for us to leave each other. So we continued to hang out until almost the middle of the day. When all was said and done, I stayed awake for 40 straight hours. It became quite surreal by the end. And I'm thinking about putting that out as a podcast. I have to listen back to it, see how cohesive it is. But you might hear that sometime next week, too. Again, hope to see you there. Thanks for listening, everybody, and take care.
We're going to start as if this is the beginning of the show. It seems we have no topics, right?
Yes, but like, looks can be deceiving.
Like, you guys don't even know why you're here.
Right.
But first of all, Davi Barker is here from California for Pork Fest.
Yep.
And I didn't want to miss an opportunity to get you in our studio. So thanks for being here. Thanks for coming
for
back
sure.
on School Sucks.
This is the first time I've been in studio.
Well, everybody who's coming here now, this is the first time they've been in studio. This is actually a new studio.
All right.
Yeah, I've only had this for 2 months. And Shire Dude from the Rebel Love Show. Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
And the YouTube channel, Shire Dude.
Right.
So one of the things I thought we could have a loose conversation about tonight is the creative process, since we're all doing our own creative
sure.
work. Davi, I've heard you talk a little bit about this before, and then Shire Dude, you could go next. Why did you become an artist and a writer? When did you become
wow.
an artist and a writer?
Okay. There's a sense in which I've always been.
Yep.
My dad was a graphic designer and he worked at home. And he did a lot of storytelling when I was a kid, just sort of making stuff up, like whenever there was downtime and kids were getting antsy about waiting for something. So when I was a kid, like I pretty much played with art programs instead of crayons.
Yeah.
And was sort of a natural at it or immersed in it. So always is the answer. But I think I decided I wanted to be a writer after reading The Max by Sam Keith. It's a comic book series. You may know it from MTV's Oddities. He's like a big purple blob that like pretends he's a superhero, but actually he's like a bum.
Is this why you named the lead character in your book Max?
It is one of the reasons, one of the many reasons why I've had an affinity for the name Max for a long time, yeah.
Yeah, it's a powerful name.
There's also Mad Max. There's also Max Brooks. There's also my first email address was maxfatal@hotmail.com. Don't email me there. I will never check it again. But no, so the thing that struck me about The Max as a comic book was it was totally different than any other comic book because it was a psychological thriller. Like, there's one of two realities happening at the same time. Either Max is a homeless person who's totally delusional, and he has a codependent relationship with a social worker, or New York is a delusion, and they're actually in Pangea, and his social worker is actually the Leopard Queen, and he is actually her protector, and they go on these weird jungle adventures. So it's like maybe Tarzan, maybe New York. You don't really know.
That's great. Isn't that kind of like 12 Monkeys, the movie? You guys have ever seen that
well,
one?
Well, yeah, kind of. It has the same sort of like, is the future real or not in that movie? Same
yeah.
sort of thing. But it made me want to be like him. Like, it struck me as such a compelling story that I'm like, I want to write compelling stories like this.
Mm-hmm. So when did you start?
Immediately.
Yeah.
I wrote a short story, or maybe it was a long story, but it was a story, and it was sort of just a ripoff of the comic book, but it was about a person who had an imaginary bunny rabbit that sort of followed them around in school. And like 6 foot tall, like sort of like Donnie Darko.
Yeah.
But this was before Donnie Darko existed, so not related at all.
Another guy. Who was the other guy who had the rabbit following him?
Well, there's Harvey.
Harvey,
that's an
with
old
Jimmy Stewart.
Myth yeah. or something. And we've talked about this on the Freedom Fiends too. There's a whole field called lepofuology, which is the study of the conjunction between UFO stories and giant bunny rabbits.
What do they need for resources?
Well, for example, the first American...
How can we help?
The first American ever abducted by aliens was Bugs Bunny, who is, for all intents and purposes, a giant bunny rabbit.
Yeah.
But other than that, there is, if you look at the stories that people have with UFO encounters, there's often a bunny in the story somewhere. Like, even if it's like in the laboratory where they're being probed, there's often a bunny rabbit there. And some UFO stories, there are people actually abducted by giant bunny rabbits. Like, they're not the gray aliens we're used to hearing about. Some people report being abducted by giant bunny rabbits. So I think this has more to do with psychology than UFOlogy, but...
Gosh, that's fascinating, though.
How are you going to major in lepofuology or whatever?
Wait, did you say it right? Is that what it was? What was it called?
Well, it's lepa is like Latin for bunny, and UFOlogy, so lepofuology.
Lepofuology. That's great.
I didn't make this up. There isn't a Wikipedia page on it. It hasn't quite broken that ground yet. But I got this from Robert Anton Wilson. I read a lot of him in the 90s.
Yep. Cosmic Trigger.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Have you read that, Shire Dude? Cosmic Trigger?
No.
Oh, my God. You'd love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm.
That's right up your alley, for sure.
Same thing. Robert Anton Wilson, huge influence, made me want to write an epic trilogy and fail.
Yeah. So when did you think you could actually, like, do it as a way to make money and have fun.
I got this advice from Taryn Lupo like 3 or 4 years ago, and I had been working on a story about an alien visiting Earth, and I kept running into these problems because it was a very complex story where like the main characters had to come from all these different countries because the alien was sort of visiting all these different countries. And so I was doing more research than writing, and I wasn't making it anywhere in the story. And so I went to Taryn Lupo. I'm like, hey, you write books. Like, how do you solve this problem? And he says, well, you just write what you know. You don't write things that you have to do mountains of research to write about. You write characters you understand in places you know.
Yeah.
And so I started writing Survivor Max, because I was a little kid who was discontent with public school, and I know the area of New Hampshire and sort of its character pretty well, and so it was a natural fit. Although you probably observed I have wasted a lot of time studying sulfuric acid in the last couple of days.
So you've been here on vacation from California, but for book research, you're really immersed in this question of what sulfuric acid can dissolve or
So there's a scene, I guess I don't want to give away too much, but maybe it's not a big deal, but the second book is largely set inside of a school, and he has to break into a locker or break out of a locker. Well, break into it first. And so the question is, like, how do you do that given you don't have power tools, given you don't have like machining equipment or whatever? And so I did some research online, and I discovered that battery acid inside of car batteries is sulfuric acid. It's 30% sulfuric acid, and that you can use that to dissolve steel. I would have thought you had to concentrate it, which you can do by boiling the water off, but actually you need to dilute it because it's a 10 to 15% sulfuric acid that dissolves steel. So you take battery acid, you add water to it, and you can melt steel.
I just love the idea of this story so much that this kid figures out all of this stuff. You know, I it's so inspiring. Speaking of batteries, like I was staring at my car battery today as I tried to change a headlight bulb in my car. And you have to take apart the whole air, not the air filter. You have to take apart the hose system to get to this particular light bulb.
Okay.
So I did it all. And, you know, at first I looked at it and I said, I'm not going to do this. This is not a project for me. Just bring it to the, you know, a place and have them change it. And I said, no, absolutely not. Not in 2015 am I not going to be able to figure out how to change my own headlight, even though it's trickier on the battery side of the car.
Okay.
Which is, so I'm like, I have my face right in the battery. So I take everything apart, set all the pieces aside, get the headlight mount out. It's a little tricky to figure out what the connection is like. There's a spark. I don't know where it came from. I persevered. I put the new bulb in. I put the assembly back together, put everything, you know, all the parts back in, went and checked it. Light doesn't work. Now, I did everything correctly, for sure. So I didn't care. I was like, I did it. I know how to do it. And I left.
I identify as having changed the light bulb. Is right. That what you're saying?
Yeah, yes. And I left all the tools that I needed, which was like a ratchet set and a flathead screwdriver and a wrench and the packaging that the light bulb came in. So if I get pulled over by the cops, he's like, hey, you got a padiddle? That's what is it, do you have that term out here? You never that's
I've never heard that.
That you guys are both from California.
Correct.
Oh, that's regional. A padiddle is one headlight.
Oh.
So the cop won't call it that, but he'll alert me to that is the situation. You have a headlight out, and then he'll check for drinking and guns and stuff and weed smells. So I'll be like, oh gosh, officer, as you can see from the pile of tools in the passenger seat, I've done the job. I put the labor in. So I was pretty satisfied. Like, didn't get the results. It was about a half hour, 45 minutes to do the whole project because I did it slowly. I want to make sure I did it right. And this is a terrible tangent where I'm just trying to say that I really admire this character and this spirit that I want to try and have more and more in life. And I hope young people read that book for this reason. I hope they're not dissolving things with battery acid in real life.
Some things need to be dissolved with battery acid. Here's the thing, though. The safety precautions are also outlined in the book.
Okay.
So, like,
right.
He's not dumb about it. Like, he breaks into the science lab. He steals the equipment that he needs to handle sulfuric acid safely.
Yeah.
And he does it properly.
I love it. But I just like his determination to solve his own problems. But it's not like he has any choice.
Yeah.
You know? Like, I have a choice. I could have just taken it to AutoZone.
I mean, you talk about creative process. This chapter was not in the first draft. Like, this whole thing was not there. And it's because I wrote him into a corner I couldn't figure out how to get him out of.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, it wasn't just like creative storytelling. It was like creative problem solving. I'm like, given this world I've built, given this scene I've built, what is available to him that he could do this with? And I like really had to rack my brain. I was thinking like, well, they amputate limbs, so there's a bone saw, so maybe he could saw the locker. And I'm like, that wouldn't work. And,
yeah, yeah.
And it happened that batteries were present, so.
Absolutely. I love it. So let's pause with that for a minute. We're going to come back to that because I have more questions about that. But let's turn it over to Shire, dude. You are a Free State Project mover.
Yeah, yeah.
You've been here for what? Like more than a year?
It was a year in May.
A year in May.
Yeah.
And we mentioned your projects. You do the Rebel Love Show, which I just was on. And I had such a fun time.
It was so goofy and wonderful. Carlos had a unicorn hat on for a while and you were doing some great impressions, and there's a great standalone clip called Walter Block Defends Eating Babies that came out of it.
Yeah. How did you feel about that?
Because I didn't really know who Walter Block was.
Really?
Like,
that surprises me.
I knew the name and I knew the title of his book, but I hadn't read his book and I'd never seen him speak. And so I couldn't tell whether or not the impression was accurate.
But then did you Google Walter Block or YouTube Walter Block and go, oh my God, Brett Van Knott is a genius?
I just assumed that. I didn't feel any need to confirm. I just assumed.
All right. So yeah, I watched the video and I said, gosh, you know, I hope that's not people's first exposure
to Walter Block.
To me or Walter Block. Walter Block.
The goal in that, though, is it's funny whether or not you know who Walter Block is. It's accessible.
It is a little bit funny. But I kind of watched that, and sometimes, like, this is what I was working on this other show that's a much more serious topic. But when you guys came here, I was editing it, and I have this question: like, I watch things that I do, or I listen to things that I say in other podcasts, like not on my show, and I say, what's really going on there? What am I doing? So I thought about that, because that Walter Block clip, like, that was kind of offensive, you know?
Yes.
Like, he put a baby in the microwave.
Yeah.
It was pretty terrible.
For 25 minutes.
That's outrageous.
That's an outrageous amount of time.
It is.
Alone, yeah.
It really, really is. So I think what it was is that I had this resentment towards Walter Block about two things. One, his inability to, like, connect with non-libertarians to sell the message of liberty. And he just like takes this academic approach,
the engineer approach instead of the salesman approach. I know exactly what you're talking
about. Right. But it's also like, what? Outrageous things are fine, you know?
Yeah.
Is defending the undefendable.
Yeah.
Indefendable, excuse me. The other one, or defending the indefensible, it must be.
I think it's undefendable.
Really?
I'm pretty sure that's what it is, yeah.
Oh, wow. Interesting. And then the other one was his attitude towards hitting children. That it was okay to hit, and that's why I kept doing the ownership thing.
Yeah.
So I have this resentment towards Walter Block. So it was actually, I was doing a good thing. I was calling. I've rationalized this. I was calling Walter Block out on his supporting
his stance on baby microwaving,
spanking, right?
Spanking.
So that's how a child came into it, right? Because
yeah.
Walter Block has this kind of careless and cavalier attitude towards the treatment of children. I just, for the sake of art. changed what he was doing to them.
It's too bad that Walter Block doesn't have a podcast, because then that could have been a whole podcast tour within itself.
Yeah,
between you and him.
Absolutely. So first question for you, a little different. What were you doing before? Because like in California, you didn't have a show. You didn't have a YouTube channel, did you?
Right. Yeah. Shire Dude didn't come to be until like right when I got here.
Right.
Yeah.
And right when you got here, you said, this is who I am. This is what I'm doing. Or how did that work?
It's really interesting, actually. Me coming here, part of the reason was I really like video editing. That's mm-hmm. something that I've always done as a hobby. And
yeah.
I don't know if I knew it beforehand or if I kind of figured it out when I got here. I don't really know when this came about, but somehow I realized that I can actually make money and make somewhat of a living. Like, I still have a day job, but I only work that 3 days out of the week, and then the rest of the time I edit video for money.
You're kidding me. How can I get into this?
Well, video editing is something like everyone films in the Free State Project, but very few people edit their stuff. They just put up raw footage.
Yeah.
And very few people who do edit, you know, edit well.
Yeah.
So if you are decent at it, you can get, you know, you can get like $35 an hour if you're decent.
From Free Staters?
Yeah. Well, I mean, not just Free Staters. I've also got work from people. Well, Free Staters who have actual jobs, like, you know, business jobs, and they don't want to have to edit this video presentation for their boss,
yeah.
they come to me instead. So I'm actually doing their work for them.
Well, I mean, that's kind of like graphic design. My primary income is graphic design, and I have a lot of free stater clients, and they pay regular graphic design wages. I make between $40 and $60 an hour, depending on the client. And it's the same thing. It's either free staters who have an organization with some money, or it's free staters who are running a campaign for some reason, or occasionally it's like piecemeal things like podcasters need web design or things like that.
Right. Yeah. Or, yeah, free staters with really good hookups. Like, there's one free stater who got me a contract with Astroglide, and I made some Astroglide commercials for the internet.
Get out of here.
True story, yeah. So it was kind of a chicken egg situation with the video editing. Like, I don't really know. I definitely came here knowing that I'd be able to do more stuff like that with a wider community of people who are into the same things that I'm into.
Yeah.
So I've actually been making some pretty decent money of video editing, and I'm trying to get longer contracts now. Like, I'm working on a contract with Alt Expo. I'm just finishing a contract of 30 videos that I've done for them.
Really?
From last Porkfest. That they've just been, these videos have been gathering dust because they don't have anyone to actually volunteer and edit them. So they realize they actually needed to pay someone. They paid me.
And they have money for that.
Yeah, they have money. They had money to pay me last time. I think actually that was a single generous donor who actually paid to pay me.
Yeah.
And so hopefully we get more donations coming up after this next Porkfest.
This is what I want to do. We should start a business.
Is edit video?
Yeah.
Well, there is that one business that started up editing, doing video production things that Bo Davis is starting. I don't know if you've heard of that one.
Oh, yeah. I've been meaning to connect with those guys. Yeah. So anyway, that's a note for me for later. So what inspired you to do the Shire Dude YouTube channel? And like, what was your approach? And people have to see these videos. I'm actually even going to make a note right here. If you do not know what we're talking about, do yourself a favor, pause this podcast, search Shire Dude on YouTube, and just watch episode one, episode two. You're talking 15, 20 minute time commitment. I can't put audio of the videos into the podcast. Hmm. Like, sometimes I do that. It just won't make any sense.
It wouldn't.
It would just be very disorienting.
Yeah, it's a lot of like farce comedy, really abstract stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Shire Dude is kind of like it's a name that I came up for myself when I was coming here. When I realized that I wanted to do video editing work,
yeah,
I was like, I'm going to need a different name because no one can pronounce my last name, which was, before it was Shire Dude, it was Vermilio. It was like a ridiculous last name. No one could pronounce it. No one could spell it. So I'm like, okay, I'll take Shire in my name. I got it from, there's someone with the last name Vandershire on Facebook.
Yeah,
and I don't know this person, but I saw Shire in the name, and I was I don't know if I know
guy.
Him in person.
Oh, you'd love him.
I might have met him, and I was like, that sounds really cool to take Shire in your name. I'm gonna steal it from him, and so I'm like, Shire what? Shire guy? Shire man? Shire person? And then the first like week or so that I was in New Hampshire, like after I had moved, people kept telling me, you sound like a surfer.
Yeah.
You sound like...
Dude is very California.
Yeah. And so I took Dude as like a kind of reminiscent of where I'm from. So my name is like where I am and where I'm from.
That's genius. Anyone who argues with this is an a-hole.
Right. Absolutely. Anyone who says that I can't pick that as a name, you know, it totally makes sense, especially explained like
that. It's kind of like the modern like Von Brussel or whatever, right? Yeah. Like you're Von Dude.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So just an insider comment there that I made that I'll explain to the people all over the world who listen to this. I was on another show called Puke in the Gang recently where one of the hosts complained about Shire Dude calling himself Shire Dude.
Yeah, some guy I've never heard of.
And said,
Puke in the Gang.
Yeah, but he said, what if I just started calling, after you build the School Sucks brand, what if I just started calling myself School Sucks Dude? I said, I'd be flattered. That'd be
Who
terrific.
Who built the Shire brand?
That's the thing. So we call New Hampshire Free State Project participants the Shire.
Yeah, and after the whole intellectual property explosion after calling it that, you would think that the people who are members of that would sort of agree with the idea of open sourcing it.
Yeah, exactly. So,
yeah, I think it's vastly different. Like no one was producing video content and calling themselves Shire before me.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Well, I'm really excited about this because now the war is escalating, the war between you and this other person,
taking it into this guy's turf.
Yeah, I think this is really exciting. We brought it to my show now. So this is how war works. It spreads.
Yeah.
It's people who shouldn't be involved become involved.
Mm-hmm.
So after you made like the first video, because it has this kind of avant-garde style, like if people aren't used to what they're seeing, it might be a little hard to follow at first.
Yeah.
You know? So after you made the first video,
did you say, like, this is a hit? Did you have questions about it? That were you kind of like waiting for feedback?
When I started, I really had no idea what I was doing. Like, I made an appearance on Rebel Love Show, mm-hmm. right? I was just a guest back then. I made the appearance as Shire Dude, but I actually hadn't produced anything yet. And so the first episode of Shire Dude is just a re-edited that episode of the Rebel Love Show where I first appeared as Shire Dude.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very like meta. Like I was Shire Dude before I even made the Shire Dude videos. And then what really was a hit, what really took off was the Porkfest episode, which is episode 2, where I did sort of a mockumentary style episode where Dogecoin had taken over Porkfest. This Dogecoin cryptocurrency, and it was the most popular currency. And I got some popular people to be in it, like Vermin Supreme and Jeffrey Tucker.
Yeah.
And once that like passed 1,000 views after I put it out, I was like, yeah, I got to finish this, like at least one season of Shire Dude, the show.
What made you decide to do it as a season? Like to have a start and a finish?
I knew I needed a break. I knew I wouldn't be able to keep it up forever. I knew that I wanted to change formats eventually. The first season is very disjointed, very inside baseball, and very abstract and obtuse.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew I couldn't keep that going forever. I could, I guess, and people here would like it, but I want a wider audience eventually. And so I'm going to branch out in season 2 and have something that's more tangible to people outside of the Shire.
Yeah, because you should have way more subscribers. But everybody I talk to, I say, have you seen Shire Dude's videos? They say, yes. Right?
Yeah.
So people are watching them. It's just, it is something that is, as far as the first season was concerned, for people who are inside New Hampshire.
Exactly.
And yeah. Pretty much for people who are inside Manchester.
Specifically. Yeah. And the Keeniacs get it too. You know, the people down in Keene.
Yeah. So those are, what else for you?
It's interesting. I wasn't, another thing that you might find interesting is I was never going to call myself Shire Dude. I was actually just going to use that as a stage name.
Yeah.
But then Daniel Cuevas, who was just on the Rebel Love Show this last episode, called me Shire Dude to my face one time. And he's the guy who came up with that, using that as an actual name that people call me.
Yeah.
So he's the first guy who called me that, and it stuck.
Do you want to change your name to that?
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm actually going to pay the government like $100 in order to do that, which I'll try to get it waived, and that'll be like a fun activism event within itself. Trying not to pay to get my name changed.
Because, well, you have a natural human right to change your name. They can't penalize you for it.
Exactly, yeah. Or I'll try to get the $100 like donated to charity instead of to wherever they want to put it.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I do like your original name, though. It's a nice name.
It's I am, in an indirect line, I am the fifth Andrew Vermilio.
Wow.
Yeah. We've got this weird name thing where we're named after our grandparents, and it goes back to the 1700s.
Oh, well, that's big with the Italians.
Right? Yes,
Now, Andrew, that's not a name I would expect, though.
It comes from Andrea. So we used to be Andrea Vermilio, and then the generation between the Andrea Vermilios were Salvatore Vermilios.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Now, so, I'm from an Italian family where nobody is named after anybody else.
Really?
Yep. There is no junior that I know of ever.
That's so strange.
Nobody ever carried a name into another generation. So, yeah.
In my family, it's middle names that we inherit.
Really?
Yeah, my middle name's Wesley. That was my father's father's first name. So the idea is the firstborn son of a firstborn son's middle name should be Wesley, but the secondborn son, or no, the firstborn son of a secondborn son's first name should be Wesley. So my middle name is Wesley because I'm the firstborn son of my dad, who's a firstborn son. But his brother, my uncle, is a secondborn son, so his firstborn son's first name is Wesley. It's too complicated.
Yeah, this must be why they didn't do it in my family. Holy because smokes. If you tried to explain it to them, they'd be like, no.
Just eyes glazed over.
No,
yeah.
We'll just come up with our own names. We understand you have a system.
See, if I ever had a kid, I'd definitely let the kid choose their own name. I'd give them like a placeholder name.
What if you didn't name your kid?
You'd have to give them something, like some placeholder name.
Well, you come up with nicknames.
We just call him Kiddo.
What's wrong with kid? My cat has a name and I still call him Cat.
Interesting.
I've called my cat's cat, Kitty.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so this is a show about creativity, so let's actually figure out how this will work, right? This is an exercise that we can do. You couldn't have a birth certificate. Right?
Without a name?
Without a first name.
I wouldn't get my kid a birth certificate anyway. I'd have them opt in should they choose.
Okay, so it's all opt in. All right, I like that. Now, how old... Do you want a kid to pick his name or her name when they're three?
When they're three, yeah. Chewbacca Thunderbolt.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? They'll grow out of it. It's just a phase. And you'll look back on it years later when her name is Samantha. And you'll say, remember the Chewbacca Thunderbolt phase? And everyone will laugh. And
yeah. Or they'll keep it forever. And then like Professor Thunderbolt.
She becomes Chewie, and everyone's like, that's such a cute name. Where'd you get the name Chewie? And then she'll say, well, it's short for Chewbacca. And they're like, you're horrible parents. And she's like, oh, no, I named myself.
Right. Oh, and that's just fun, yeah.
So it's like they could re-up every year.
There you go. Yeah.
I love that.
Or whenever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, they would know that it gets annoying for other people to change what they call you. And so like, I think you lose a lot of social capital if you keep changing your name over and over again.
Well, no. I mean, you can't be changing it. Like, you can't go into work when you're 32 and be like, now it's Steve. Yesterday it was Richard, but now it's Steve.
Believe me, yeah, getting my coworkers to call me
called
Shire,
to HR.
Dude. Yeah.
Why not? Why couldn't you do that?
Well, okay.
Transgender people have to do that.
But he's talking about social capital, right?
Yeah.
So, like, one of the things that I think counts for social capital is, like, consistency, reliability.
Sure. Yeah.
So if you're just coming in and saying, now it's Kevin, like, people are gonna think you're kind of flaky,
right? Yeah, just one name change for me at work. Like, I tell people, yeah, you can call me Shire Dude now. Yeah, that's my name. And they're like, no, we're not calling you that. There's no way.
Right,
just one name change is too much for them.
This has such a feel of a live show, but we're not live. I love this. I think this is so nice.
I'm live.
I feel pretty alive right now. Yeah.
Oh, I mean, like, we're not talking to anybody else right now. It's just the three of us.
Right.
But this, I like the feel of this.
Well, you know, if you consider the NSA, you really could live your entire life as a live show.
Absolutely.
But that's another thing.
There's a guard somewhere watching everything you do. He deserves to be entertained.
Anytime you're in this room, Brett, you should feel like you're being watched.
I don't know. I mean, maybe information is being gathered, but I don't think anybody
is actually sitting and watching right now.
Absolutely not. I mean, there are cameras on us, but I don't think anyone. Now, see, if there was a call I could make and be like, hey, the last hour of my life was fantastic. You should watch it.
That'd be great.
Like, yeah, if you could just go and, like, look, just pull a WAV file of 8:45 to, like, 9:45 and kick back. You're welcome. You're going to love it.
Can you do me a favor and send me November 5th, 1955? Because I remember that being a really good day, you know?
Why did you pick that date?
I pulled that date from Back to the Future.
Okay, I was going to say.
Yeah.
I was going to say, if you just pulled that randomly.
That was the day I invented time travel.
What a coincidence.
Yeah.
That was the date from Back to the... Or wait, was it November 15th?
November 5th, 1955.
So you're saying Back to the Future use remember the 5th of November?
I'm gonna do a gentleman's wager. I'm going to do a gentleman's wager. I think it was November 15th.
A gentleman's wager. I'll accept.
All right.
November 5th, 1955. I've seen that movie at least 100 times.
Well, okay. It was the first movie I ever owned on VHS.
Oh,
me and my dad went down to Video Place in 1986, and
you know,
paid $75 for it.
Wow.
Yep.
For a VHS.
Yeah, I think I've told that story on the show before.
Great.
Sorry,
it
everyone.
It's also the first movie I've ever paid a video editor for.
Really?
Yeah, I paid someone to put it all in chronological order for me. So I have a three-hour cut of Back to the Future that begins in the 1800s with a car showing up with no explanation and ends in the future with them going, we're going back, the end.
That's great. So it goes 3-1-2. Right?
Well, it's spliced together.
Oh, okay. So everything's perfectly chronological.
So you did like a Godfather trilogy.
That's great.
Out of Back to the Future. I love that.
I know
it works. It's fun.
There's like one fan bit where there's like five DeLoreans at one point in time in the Back to the Future chronology.
Okay.
Yeah, and I don't know how we get to there, but it's like...
Well, there's also the problem of the alternate future where Biff is in control, or Buff or whatever his name is.
Biff.
Right, right.
That you have to cut because it didn't end up actually happening.
Yeah. Oh,
wow. That just blew my mind.
Yeah, you have to cut that whole sequence out of the chronological version, but you still have people referring to it in the 50s. So
they say October 21st.
That's not right.
Back to the Future countdown to October 21st, 2015. That's when they show up in the future.
Yeah.
See, I thought they used the same date. Like, they never changed the month and day. They only ever changed the year.
Yeah, I was talking about the day that he invented time travel.
Okay, so October 21st, 2015 is Back to the Future Day. The day when they show up in the year 2015. And what a ridiculous world that was.
Right.
Too bad or will be.
Would you think we're not there yet?
Nah, I mean...
Well, I mean, Jurassic World is not that different from Jaws 34. Especially if you see it in 3D.
Jaws 34.
So, I mean, our world is so much better.
No, well, there's no flying cars.
There's no flying skateboards.
I know, but would we? Do we want flying cars?
I want to be able to feed my flying car trash and have it fly.
Yeah.
Okay. Have you driven in Boston, the city of Boston, Massachusetts? I would like you to go down there and just observe the driving for a day, and then you decide if you would want to take your chances airborne with those people. So
hopefully we'd have some sort of swarm technology.
Or the smart. If it was
self-driving.
Like smart, self-driving, yeah. Self-flying cars, I'd be all for that.
What about self-fitting clothes?
Is that useful for me? Yeah, I change sizes a little bit. I would like self-fitting clothes. Hydrated food.
Right. Yeah.
I have problems in my fridge right now, like storage-wise. Like there's too much stuff in there. So maybe that is a better world. We'd be faxing each other, and I don't know how this podcast would work. But we'd have, well, wait a minute.
Skype works.
Oh, wait. Remember the big screens they had?
Yeah.
Where they would talk to each other on like big telescreens?
Yeah.
Could I do the podcast that way?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So everybody, so it's like a conference call.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then instead of like writing show notes or having a website, I just send them faxes.
You could start every episode with, you're fired.
Yeah. Yeah.
It'd be great.
Exactly. So what else was there? The hoverboard, obviously.
Right.
That was it.
Was there any like cyborg stuff? Did Biff have like a robot arm or anything like that?
I remember feeling like he was part. He had something in his neck. He would turn his neck and it would make a machine sound.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was that about?
Just unexplained sound effect there. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
I'm for cyborg parts.
Oh, sure.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Especially if there's a fax machine built in. Did you ever play this game, maybe as a kid, but maybe even as an adult, of what superpower would you want? If you could have any superpower in the world, what would it be?
Yeah. Yeah.
What I always asked for was the ability to conceptualize and produce a business card in the amount of time it took to pull it from my pocket. So I could pull any credential from my pocket at will.
Wow.
Like Doctor Who.
Does he do that?
So Doctor Who has this stuff called psychic paper.
I'm listening.
So what it is it's just like a blank pad of paper, and as soon as he pulls it out and says whatever he wants the person to see, that's what it is.
That's what I want. That's my superpower.
Now, Doctor Who...
It's much less original if Doctor Who has it.
Now, the first time I ever saw it was... You guys, you do watch Doctor Who... Shire Dude,
I don't watch Doctor Who. I don't watch it.
I started season 9.
I've seen maybe 3 episodes in my life.
And then I didn't keep going after I got to like 10.
All right, so season 9, I think the guy who was only the Doctor for 1 year, Christopher Eccleston.
Yes.
British I think he's a stage actor. And then David Tennant replaced him, and then Matt Smith. And I think, is Matt Smith still Doctor Who?
No idea.
What season are you in?
I stopped at 10.
All right.
See, I'm an X-Men fan, right? So for me, like, superpowers should be quasi-biological. So I always imagined it was, like, combination of, like, chameleon versus the shedding of skin cells. So it was like I was producing, like, a snake shed skin, a business card with my phone number on it.
Oh, that's creepy.
Yeah, that is. Let me make sure I'm understanding that. I'm not sure I am.
Okay. So his skin sheds off of his hand and like, turns into a business card.
It would be sort of like, because I have these chameleon cells in my hand, they become like a dot matrix printer. And then because I can shed them like snake's skin, they can produce any paper material. And I can go from conceptualizing a piece of printed material to producing a piece of printed material in the amount of time it takes to hand it to a person.
Would you be able to do like full size banners as well? Like if you took a lot of time?
If I kept hydrated? I don't know. This was me in like middle school fantasizing about a superpower.
Creepy one at that.
Now, that's amazing. You thought of that before 3D printing, because that's kind of...
It kind of is.
It's like bio 3D printing.
It's like paper. It's like a printer that prints paper and ink at the same time.
Wow.
I was a weird kid. I came into the U.S. school system in second grade, And so I was like kind of an outcast because like these other kids had like grown up through kindergarten and they all knew each other and they had a reputation. So I was the new kid with like strange customs. And so I started this rumor, or I told this story, that I was an alien, that I was an extraterrestrial. And I was actually from a highly advanced species where the custom was to abort or annihilate retarded babies to preserve the gene pool. Well, my parents didn't have the heart to do that, so they had to find a planet so amazingly primitive that I would fit in, but they kind of overshot, and so here I am.
How old were you when you came up with this?
That was second grade.
That's amazing. I just told people I had superpowers. I just went for it.
It still says on my Facebook page in the about section, my ethnicity is pre-op extraterrestrial. I'm just waiting to find out what my species looks like, and then I'm going to get the surgery.
Where were you before that, before second grade? Where did you come from?
I did first grade in Saudi Arabia, and then we traveled around the country or around the world, India, China, Thailand, Maldives.
Wow.
My dad was doing personnel software for the military, so we moved around a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
God, that's fascinating. What would have even inspired you to come up with such a story?
I don't know. Too much science fiction. I honestly didn't have a good concept of countries at that age. Because I watched a lot of Star Trek and I got on a lot of planes, and so I sort of in my mind thought I was going to different planets.
Might as well be. Yeah, yeah.
I just remember like telling I watched Superman 2 over and over again.
Yeah,
when I was in second grade. And I just decided, I said, that's what I've got to, I got to have that. I got to be that. And I would just run around the playground at school and like rip my shirt open.
Yeah.
Like he did. Yep. And then just kind of like stick my arms out. And no one was buying it. They're like, yeah. You're never leaving the ground, Brett. Your feet are running, you know, and you're just flying with the top part of yourself. It's like, give it up, man. But you had this story that was like, for a second grader, practically unfalsifiable.
People believed it. That was the crazy. Because it's not that much of a leap for a second grader to believe the aliens are out there, right? So, of course, like, if they met one, that would be enough proof.
Are you comfortable telling your age?
Yeah, I'll do the math, though. It's 2015, so I'm 34.
Okay, so I'm 37. So I was in second grade in 1984 and 85. And you would have been like
89.
All right. So what would we had E.T.?
Yeah. Okay. We watched E.T. I'm a generation behind most people in television because in Saudi Arabia, you can't get American television. And so we had like bootleg smuggled in VHS tapes of old television.
Yeah. Like from the 70s?
Yeah.
Like MASH?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
Old He-Man cartoons was big.
That was a wacky show. Jeez. I mean, going back and watching some of that stuff now, the Transformers.
Yeah.
The original, that was...
Or the GoBots.
We didn't go for the GoBots. We knew. But yeah, I'm just trying to think, like, what would have been like a context for people that age to really understand aliens at that time? Because E.T., like, humanoid aliens...
E.T. is probably, I mean, I don't remember this specifically, but if you were to be sort of like a mental archaeologist, E.T. is a very similar story, right? Like a parental alien leaves a child alien on the planet, child alien bonds with child human, like, and they, whatever they, it is that they do, they synchronize, right? But it's the same idea that it is a young alien left on Earth to its own devices. That was sort of the story I was telling.
I just had an amazing thought. I'm listening to you, but I'm also just doing a Google search here.
On the lepophoology front, the first life form E.T. encounters is a bunny rabbit.
Oh, wow.
That is, people can't see the face I make when my mind is blown.
He's like left up on the hill, right? And he's like working around in the grass, and you see bunny rabbits hopping away from the site.
All right. Are you ready for something even stranger? This is almost bringing tears to my eyes. The year you made up that story, do you know what movie came out?
No.
Earth Girls Are Easy.
I didn't see it.
All right. It's Jim Carrey, Jeff Goldblum.
Whoa.
And one other guy, I forget who, cast and crew, Damon Wayans.
Okay.
And they're aliens who look like people.
And they're here because Earth Girls Are Easy?
They're here for the girls.
Wow. That's almost identical to Davi's story.
Now, can you imagine? Yeah. Can you imagine Davi's classmates like going to the movies? And just, you know,
was this age appropriate for second graders? Were these kids going to Earth Girls or Easy?
But I'm sure back then the rating system was different. I'm sure that movie was rated G.
Yeah.
Okay.
But imagine being one of Davi's classmates, and you're in this, you're in the movies watching this, and you're like, holy shit. One of these guys is in my class. Wow.
So I can do a another impression, Jeff Goldblum, but I can only do Jeff Goldblum enthusiastically agreeing with you.
Ah, yes, yes, yes. Yes, yes, yes.
That's it.
Yes, 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 yes. Ah, yes. Yes, yes.
Is he doing anything?
I met him in New York a few years ago, maybe like 5 years ago. He was at a play I was at. My mom was talking to him. And I went up and I said, hey, my uncle produced the play. And I said, hey, I'm Frederick Zolo's nephew. And he said, yes, yes, yes. Ah.
All right.
You didn't even have to reach in your pocket and grab the skin business card that said that you were that guy's nephew.
No, he didn't care. And then it turns out that that's all he says. So he could have been in total disagreement with me, but those are the words he knows.
Ah, yes, yes, yes. Ah.
So anyway, I wanted to jump off of Davi's story to you. As a young man, what did you do that was creative then, right?
Oh, because well, I started with video a long time ago. Yeah. Back in 2005, so this is 10 years ago, I got a digital camera as a gift for like Christmas or my birthday or something.
Yeah.
And immediately, I didn't take pictures with it. I made videos with it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like a point and click camera, so I could only shoot like 3 minute shots. Like maximum before it stopped itself from recording.
Yeah,
really old school, you know, like half a megapixel is nothing. And I just used like Windows Movie Maker and I made really terrible videos.
Yeah,
and I still have like all of them. And that just became a thing that I did on the regular. I'd write scripts, and then my friends would get together and we'd go out for the day and we'd film a video. And I made like half an hour features.
How old were you when you were doing this?
Oh, this is, halfway through high school.
Halfway through high school. Okay, because you're younger than us, right?
I'm 25.
Okay, so like by 10 years. It's interesting that thinking about something like fantasy, right? When I was little, it was all in my head, right? So it wasn't that there were no outlets, but I just didn't know any.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I first got a tape recorder and I would just like do like skits into a tape recorder and I would just save the tapes, but that was all I had. And then I wound up creating this whole elaborate fantasy world that was based pretty much on baseball. It was very strange. it's very strange too. It wasn't very strange. It was exactly what I needed at the time. But it's difficult to explain to other people. And then it just expanded and became larger and larger. And I had to keep track of all the characters in notebooks. No, now I'm thinking like I remember getting a video camera, like a VHS camcorder.
It's a really inspiring moment when you first get the ability to film something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we would make videos of my brother. This was by the time I was like getting to be a little older. Maybe I was like becoming a teenager. My brother would impersonate the local weatherman, Al Kaprelian.
Yeah.
Do you know who that is?
No.
Oh, he's a wacky weatherman. Like, so we would film that. And then we would do like variety shows where he would be the weatherman and I would do skits. So that was it. I wish I could have gotten into video sooner. I wish there was a way to do it.
I want to hear about Baseball World.
Baseball World was weird. all right. So I remember just getting like really into baseball when I was, I don't know, seven years old maybe. And I would play whenever I could. I mean, you know, there was T-ball and then there was like farm team baseball. Back then it was probably T-ball. And like around the time I got to be, but I was like a fat kid and I wasn't very athletic and actually just playing wasn't satisfying. So I wanted to be like superstar baseball player. Mm-hmm. So I would go out and pretend to be like the Red Sox.
I was huge. I mean, I still love baseball. I think baseball is a great game, but I don't follow it like professional baseball closely anymore. And I said, well, this is, I'm clearly not these people, you know, like the people who were on the team in like 1986, 1987. I know I'm not them. So I started making up players, right? But then for some reason, and I can't remember why, it wasn't modern times. I created this whole backstory that went all the way back to like the 1800s.
Okay.
And like made then like, and it was just the real teams that are in the major leagues, right? But it kind of like was my own version of the history of the sport. And I had players and I would go out and play games as these players.
That's kind of wild.
It's
like, it's sort of like fantasy baseball, only it's actually like a fantasy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I couldn't make any money. There was no prizes.
Hmm.
But so then we had this strange shaped yard. And it was like a baseball field. My dad had like had the trees cut out so we could like play back there. But it was very narrow. Like a baseball field is wide open, you know, but it was like a chute. But so I started like doing like stadium designs that would look like the yard. But then I figured out how to do like architectural drawings. Mm-hmm. So I started with what our yard actually was. But then I imagined this whole giant stadium that I was playing in, and I drew it, and I would draw it from like different angles, and like try to scale it, like using rulers and graph paper, and like I would draw what the seats looked like, and there was this like rock wall, so I imagined it was like this giant fence, and it became very, very elaborate. And I mean, I can still remember, like if you said a number, I could probably tell you the significance of that number in this world. Like if you
37.
Just 37 19 37 was the Red Sox were the best team. They won the World Series every year, right? When I was little, because I mean, you're little, you just want to win. You don't want like, you know, a dramatic story. 1937 was the 1 year in the 1930s that the Red Sox didn't win the World Series.
Who'd they lose
to? What happened?
I don't remember who they lost to. I they didn't have their best player who came the next year in 1938. And then after that, they won every year that he was on the team. He was the best. One more number before this gets too weird.
Eight.
There was a player in the 1980s, and his name was Jeff Clark. And he was an outfielder, and he wore number eight. And we could do this for an hour.
Wow.
But that would be ridiculous.
So this is this big immersive world that you created.
Yeah. And there were notebooks. I talked about this actually on a recent show. There were all these notebooks that I would keep track of, like even stats. And they all had ridiculous stats. Like they could hit over, I mean, if you guys don't follow baseball, like the season record for home runs, I think is 70. Barry Bonds did it. I think it's 70 or like right around 70. Mm-hmm. These guys would hit like 150, 200 home runs. They would bat like over 500. Like the highest batting average in a season, I think was like, I mean, the average batting average is
two
like
home runs per pitch.
Yeah, the pitchers were ambidextrous, and they would throw two balls at once, yeah. And the guy would
both out of the park.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Two baseballs. You have to.
Oh, two bats. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Two bats. See that? Now that's creativity. Why didn't I think of that? Why did I make the rules exactly the same? These guys
mixing up the stadium is pretty creative. If I'm imagining it right, you're talking about like a longer diamond, right?
Well, no. I mean, the baseball diamond was still the same dimensions, but you had to work. Now, in the old ballparks, some examples would be like Ebbets Field, which was in Brooklyn, or even Fenway Park has a very strange shape. Like out in California, where you guys are from, they had all the land in the world to build like Dodger Stadium or Candlestick Park.
Sure.
You know? So they could all just be like these open, cookie cutter, perfectly circular type stadiums surrounded by parking lots. But when they built the original ballparks, like in the 1910s and the 1920s, they couldn't do that because they had to build them in cities. They had to use the available space of like a city block. Hmm. So the old parks have some really strange shapes. Like Ebbets Field there was one that where the New York Giants played. It was called the Polo Grounds, right? So down the right and left field line, it was like 240 feet, which is like a little league field. But then it was 480 feet in center field.
Weird.
So it was like a chute, basically. You know, it looked more like a football field shape than a baseball field shape. So I knew that at the time, and I said, I mean, even Fenway Park has a famous, like, it's called the Green Monster, this giant wall in left field that's like 35 feet tall.
Okay.
But it's only 315 feet to the wall, where typically it's like 330, 340 feet. So sometimes, like, balls that should be caught by the left fielder are home runs, and sometimes balls that should be, like, way, way gone home runs hit the wall and fall down, you know, depending on their trajectory.
Hmm.
So the dimensions, to answer your original question, the dimensions of the field were the same, like the distance between the pitcher's mound and home plate and first base. But then, like, baseball can be, the shapes of the fields can be different.
Okay.
Right?
I didn't
where
know that.
Where they can't be in football, you know, or like every football field is 50 yards wide, 100 yards long. The end zone is 10 yards deep. Basketball, every court's the same size.
So then, I mean, that seems like it would throw off any home run stat if, like, you're more likely to hit home runs in one park than another.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing. Like, some people want to play in Boston because, you know, if they hit, they swing under the ball and they hit, like, really high things that would be caught typically by the left fielder in Fenway Park, it could be a home run, you know? So that's one of the things that's so interesting about baseball is every time you go to a new stadium, I mean, there's 162 games in a year. You're playing 81 of them in other stadiums. So every right. stadium is different. And it makes the game more interesting.
Okay.
So my stadium was awesome. It had some very interesting characteristics, including, for some reason, there was this jut out of seating behind first base 110 feet from home plate where people could hit little home runs because there was a blueberry bush there. So for me, it was just, I pretended it was people.
So you could hit up and over first base,
and there was just like this little area that stuck out.
And that's a home run.
And it would be a home run if it went into the seats. But then behind the seats, there was more fields. It just like was this little thing that jut out.
Now it sounds like
my mom had planted a blueberry bush there, and there was nothing I could do about it. I couldn't rip it up and be like, Mom, look. I couldn't like show her the blueprints and be like, look, this can't be here. You know?
But yeah.
It doesn't make any sense in my world.
Instead, it led you to victory. So, I mean, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. You made it a positive.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And then it kind of expanded as my interest changed. Like, I would incorporate other things into this world, or like the people in this world. What else could they do? One of them was a movie star. Why not? But I wasn't totally satisfied or excited by the world that they gave me. They said, hey,
yeah,
you know, you'll go to school, you'll fill out these things, you'll get on this bus. I just thought all that kind of sucked. So I did my own thing.
Hmm. Yeah, I used to do these little narcissistic comics of myself. As a superhero.
Now we're getting into it.
It was just named Super Andrew. And, like, literally, it was just a guy who looked like Superman, but he had a cape and it had an A on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had Super Dave. But
yeah.
Super Dave turned out to actually be a motorcyclist or something.
Oh.
Yeah, Super Dave Osborne.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I had Super Kid, which I wrote and won the Young Authors Contest in first grade. Which was, it was the Superman story.
Yeah.
But it was just me. And I even drew pictures and then just cut out photos of my head and pasted them on.
Oh, wow. That's an extra step.
Yeah.
So what was Super Andrew?
He had pretty much unlimited powers. Any power that he needed at the time, he had. And I'd fill up notebooks just like comic book style where, each page was a new panel. And so I'd fill up the whole panel with me fighting a new villain. And it was pretty intricate. And I'd filled up like 10 notebooks, you know, like standard size. And it was just like pencil drawings.
So is this something everybody does, or are we weird? Does every person out there have a stack of notebooks from when they were kids of the weird things they imagined? Or is this like something unique about people like us?
I was deprived from television as a kid. And
yeah, I was
so
too.
I did that instead. What about you, Brett?
Well, when I was a kid, we didn't really have television. I mean, it existed, but there was only, you know, same thing for you. I mean, being in Saudi Arabia, we only had like 10 channels, you know, and there was nothing ever on. I remember when it would be Saturday morning, it was so exciting when I was a little kid because all Super Friends, I totally wanted to get Super Kid into that, the Hall of Justice and all that, Superman, Batman, all of them together. That was an awesome show. And then there were like these Hanna-Barbera cartoons that I would watch, Birdman.
Yeah.
Oh, Birdman was awesome.
I was a big Gummy Bears fan. Did you ever watch Gummy Bears?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, that was awesome. So outside of that, like, I couldn't come home from school and be like, Mom, I'm going to watch TV for hours. Like, she wouldn't have allowed me to do that. And I remember, like, I became latchkey when I was like 13, and that was right when we got cable. So I would come home, I would watch Yo MTV Raps, The Grind. I remember The Grind. Eventually, I think The Real World. I think that started when I was like a freshman in high school. The first reality TV show.
Right.
Yeah. But I had to grow up without any kind of, we had some kind of video game system that was like Frogger.
Like an Atari or something?
No, it was a computer. It was a Texas Instruments computer, but the monitor was the television.
Okay.
And then maybe when I was like in fifth or sixth grade, we got Nintendo.
Yeah.
But we were limited how much we could do that. And we would all flip out. Like when it was just like we would throw the controllers and then we'd get taken away. We'd get mad.
Yeah. We used to play Tetris and Total Rampage were like the big games in our house. And they were both games that would go on forever, but you couldn't save. And so being told to like go to bed or being told to come to dinner or whatever essentially meant losing like 5 hours of progress.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Well, I remember the first one you could was Zelda that I ever remember was The Legend of Zelda for the original NES. And I was like, and you could save and go back to right where you were the first day. And it was an adventure and you would accumulate stuff.
Yeah.
And it was like I had some kind of purpose in life and worth. And I was like, I'm dropping out of school. I am dropping out
I'm
of
a
school.
Professional
Mom, come look at this. Yeah. Come look at this raft, this blue ring. Watch what happens when I put on the blue ring. There's nothing like this in the real world that can compare. But I pursued my fantasy world through that. You know, I kept doing all that stuff. Even once I had Nintendo, I just had to schedule things better.
I did role-playing games. Dungeons and Dragons, Vampire the Masquerade.
No.
I still do that. I have a once a week meeting with old high school friends and we still run games.
And you do it in person?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. So what are the games you do now?
I am running a game called Blanaby of the Dead. Blanaby is a small town in the middle of the Tahoe National Forest that's being overrun by zombies. And my friend Jason is running a game called Apocalypse, which is essentially based on Mad Max. It's a Mad Max-like world where one of the players is a driver and he's recruiting people for sort of a heist.
Yeah.
But we're not Facebook players anymore. Like, we're all sort of like, we come up with our own systems, we come up with our own character sheets, and it's all custom now.
Yeah, we did this a couple years ago where we were all superheroes.
Yeah, that's the next one in line is there's a superhero game. I forget what it's called. It's called like Dresden Files or something. But in that one, I plan on playing an African archer who's like brought to New York and has to acclimate.
I was a reptilian.
Yeah.
And I controlled the world's banks in our game.
Was a reptilian.
So it's time for us to move into Act 3, which I guess would be Act 3 tips for kids.
Tips for kids? Don't throw the notebooks away.
No, I wish I still had those.
Mm. I do. I have one of those financial boxes, record boxes full of old stuff.
Yeah. What do you think's in there? I mean,
a lot of drawings, a lot of Ninja Turtles fan fiction. I wrote a story where it was mandatory journal writing in this one class where, like, for the first 10 minutes of every class, you have to write something in this journal, and it was supposed to be about developing this thing, but I resented it being mandatory. And so I ended up writing an ongoing story about the demise of the teacher. And because she was grading, or he was grading, it was Mr. Lavelle. And so it was a story where Mr. Lavelle was cryogenically frozen, and he was awoken hundreds of centuries later to a time when... because of civil rights movements and things like that, the human species had evolved to the point where all gender and racial differences sort of meted out in the middle, and there was just sort of one gender and one race, and it was sort of this like gray, nondescript human shape. And they were like shocked and appalled by his maleness and his whiteness.
Yeah.
And so, and so he became a sort of like curiosity for like a public zoo.
Nice.
Because they just couldn't understand, like, why did he have these traits? They hadn't seen these traits in humans for 100 generations.
All right, so what did you get for a grade?
I don't remember.
Well, what did I guess what I'm asking is, what was his response?
It was just a pass or fail thing. If you filled the pages, you passed. I kind of vaguely remember him appreciating it or thinking it was creative or something.
Yeah.
He wasn't upset, which was good. So
yeah, we wound up me and like three of my friends. It started with me and one other friend, my friend Brian. We started writing a book, I think in I feel like it was eighth grade. It was about this British band. We were devastated when we found out like Spinal Tap had already been done. We didn't know, but they were called the Satanic Insane Anarchists. That was the name of the band.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah, and they changed their name at one point to something else. But we started like telling the story from like the 1960s because we thought those were like the three worst things: Satanic, Insane, and Anarchist. At the time.
Sure, of course.
Right, and then like that we would just pass it. We would just meet in the hall and like we'd hand it off to the other person.
Oh, that's great.
So we would sit in class and read what the other person had written and just laugh in class and get in trouble. Never got it taken away, though. And I mean, it got to be like a stack of papers. And then we started giving it to other people, and they could write in it, too.
That's phenomenal.
And then I think at one point we tried to hand it in English class. And the teacher was like, this is very disturbing. Because most of it had been written. The teacher was he was a really cool guy. But he was like, there's nothing we can do with this as far as like putting this on the record. You know, like this can't be entered into the grade book. Yeah, just have fun with it, I guess. But yeah, that was a fun project.
I had a similar project like that in eighth grade algebra, where it was a stick figure version of the teacher chasing an X, which was also like a character. The letter X, yeah. Okay. He was just chasing this X throughout all these scenes. And what was interesting was I'd pass it back and forth between the guy next to me. We both ended up failing algebra for one. it rhymed.
Finding X.
The entire thing was a poem, a really long poem that we had written. And each line rhymed with the next. And so like I'd give him a line to start with, and then we'd keep rhyming with that one word for the entire class. And we wouldn't pay any attention to the class like the entire time.
And you never got caught?
I think he figured out what we were doing maybe like halfway through the school year, but he just let it go. He didn't care.
Yeah, those teachers. God, I remember the penis game too.
What's the penis game?
What? Yeah, that sounds very ominous, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Very
sounds
threatening.
Like something Walter Block plays.
Why wouldn't I play the penis game? All right, so in middle school, this originated. You find the classroom of a teacher who is particularly deaf, and people start saying penis. This is the class, and the teacher's talking about the volume of my voice. And, you know, we're in a room about the size of these two rooms together, and someone just says penis. Like, maybe at that volume, and then somebody else says penis, penis, penis. Oh, great. We found the title for the show.
The penis game.
Yeah.
Great.
I was wondering what we were going to call it.
Could it be Walter Block's penis game?
No, I got to keep Walter. I don't want Walter Block coming after me.
I was in a bar and grill where there were people playing this game, like adults playing this game.
Yeah. Okay. So we did it in middle school, and I was the only one I ever knew of who got caught.
Oh. Well, that means you won.
That means you lose.
Oh.
Because you are asked to leave the class for shouting penis.
You said it the loudest, though. Isn't that the point?
No. And like when you're the only one who's been detected, it's very, very strange. And you can't be like, no, 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 no.
We were all shouting penis.
The teachers, Mr. Tilden, no, it was Ben and Danny and Andrew. They were all shouting penis, too. And I was just the last one to do it. So I had to go the loudest. I couldn't say that. I just had to hang my head and walk out of the class.
Yeah, there's no explaining at that point.
And then I think when I got out into the hall, I heard somebody else say it. So what are the lessons for the young folks here? Now our audience has a lot of, you know, I was telling this story to somebody who's an unschool parent recently. And they my fantasy stories, and they're like, it's fantastic. You know, if you ever felt weird about that, you should come see what unschool kids do. So I do worry today that it's getting harder for kids to rely on their own imaginations, you know? Like, at one point for me, it was all I had. And it was a fascinating, fun time. And a rewarding time, too. Like, figuring things out, like how things would work together in some kind of imaginary scenario. And it's not just that kids have less opportunities to do that now because of overstimulation, but they also have less time, you know? Like, I just remember, like, having a whole afternoon to explore and run around and do baseball and have adventures. Sure. I made up movies too, you know, like movies that I was in They were all like really similar to Star Wars, though. It's all the same idea. It was all like space and like in snow. Oh, and the winter was the best. Snow planet.
Sure.
I loved snow planet. Diving around in snowbanks, avoiding laser guns. That was great.
I guess the best advice to kids is just to keep playing.
Yeah.
And if you're an adult and you stopped, start playing.
Well, what does that mean?
I kind of, you know, I think play is a necessary part of a healthy brain.
Yeah.
And if it isn't like creating imaginary baseball worlds, like maybe it's playing a board game or something, but like do something. God, there was this book called The Flow Experience by Csikszentmihalyi. I'm not going to try and spell that. But it was talking about the attributes of the mind at play. And it's that the moment you're in is intrinsically enjoyable for what it's doing. And whether or not it goes on for 5 minutes or 5 hours is irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that state of being, that state of mind is almost like a necessary recuperation period for the brain if it's going to be engaged in any sort of like work.
Yeah. Yeah, that, yeah, like most people, and I've caught myself like in work mode for way too long.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good when your work is creative.
Yeah.
Right? But being able to like just step away from all of that and get into something else is really important. But, you know, doing creative work has really been a blessing, I think. What advice do you have, Shire Dude? Based on the lessons you've learned.
Based on the lessons I've learned. I've been getting a lot of ideas lately. This is going to sound really weird. From my dreams.
Really?
Yeah. And so it's always important, I find, to have something to write on at all times. And now that we have cell phones, you always have like a notepad in your phone at least.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, especially upon waking, having something near you when you're asleep to immediately when you wake up to write down whatever you just dreamt. That's been really big for me lately in coming up with fresh ideas.
Can you give us an example?
Not off the top of my head, but I have actually been researching this. This is going to kind of dive into something just for a second though. There's this herb that people take that shamans used to take in Africa called Kalea Zakarachichi.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard of that one?
No.
And it's, if you take it in like a tincture form, it gives you like really zany, like lucid dreams.
Get out of here.
Yeah, and you can get it off Amazon, and it's totally, like, legal, and so you don't have to worry about that. And I definitely want to get my hands on some of that. I've been having really strange dreams lately where they seem like they've been taking a really long time, and I haven't been good about writing them down. And I feel like this could be, like, a whole new season of Shire Dude.
Based on your dreams. Just, do you remember any of the dreams you've had?
Yeah, I've had, let's see, probably the most trippy dream that I've had in the past was where it was a double dream. I was being chased by an alligator, through my grandma's house. Most of my dreams end up in my grandparents' house, which I think is pretty normal. But I'm being chased by an alligator and I tried to jump up onto a surface that's like way too high for me. And I'm like really short and I wake up, but here's the thing. I wake up into another dream and I see myself from a third person perspective, sitting up in bed and looking in a mirror. And it was the strangest thing.
That's really freaky.
I had thought at that point that I was outside my own body. And I was completely convinced that that was reality.
You thought it was like the end of 2001 Space Odyssey. Yeah.
And then I woke up for real and I was like super feverish and sick. So, but yeah, that was a really trippy experience. And that would be great to have in some sort of Shire Dude-esque video.
Yeah.
Some sort of out-of-body experience.
Have you ever done any dream analysis?
Not too much. I've tell some people about my dreams, and I've actually had one person tell me that I am actually astral projecting. So I'm going to go with that. I'm going to say that's what I'm doing.
And so you're actually in your grandparents' house.
I'm actually traveling to the same location over and over
with
again.
A very small astral body.
Yeah. Another interesting thing too is in my grandpa's old house, there's a secret passageway that always seems to be in the dream, and it doesn't exist really, but it's just behind a mirror. And I know in the dream it does exist. It's like this whole other room.
Yeah, I have a lot of dreams where there's no evidence of it, like readily apparent, but I know that the entire setting is on a boat.
Yeah.
Like there's no rocking. I don't see any portholes with water or anything, but I'll be like, I'm in a shopping mall and it's just like understood. This is a mall on a boat. And, like, I don't know why that's very common for me.
Hmm. Yeah, sometimes like those really realistic dreams are kind of scary when you wake up from them. They feel so real, but they're so demented.
Right.
Like I remember one dream I had, I lived on the west side of town. This was years ago.
and I'm walking with like a suit carrier, like that you know, like the thing you bring suits on and on an airplane. Hmm. And I've got it over my shoulder, and I just walk out of my house, and I remember walking down the street and hearing the sound of the street like under my feet. How realistic it was, like going down the end of my street, turning down the next street, like all that, like exactly as the houses were. And I'd only been on this street a couple of times. And I remember going and looking at it later and seeing like, gosh, I remember that doorway from the dream. And I didn't even remember noticing it before, you know? And I remember walking into this house, but then walking out really quickly and then like being stopped by, I think, the police, but they were plainclothes. And they say, "We know what you did." And they said, "Open the bag." Right? So I open the bag. Guess what's in there?
Heads.
You each know. It's a suit bag. So you each get two guesses.
Okay. A police uniform.
No. Wouldn't that be something? But you're in the... I don't want to say you're in the ballpark, because then when I tell you what it is, you'd be like, well, that's kind of offensive to police. What?
Oh. Yeah, see, now I can't guess after that. That's seems offensive to police. I'm trying to use the clues given to me now.
It's a thing that people get offended if you compare it.
Is it you have a pig in your bag? Those are my two guesses.
It's like mob attire. It's like a pinstripe suit.
No. It is a World War II Nazi general's uniform.
Whoa.
Brett Venazzi.
Oh, nicely done. That was quick wit. Thanks. Damn. So I'm just looking at it and...
Look, these aren't mine, officer.
And we're all just like, it was on the ground. I remember like the bag was open on the ground and we're all just looking at it. And I remember I said, "I don't know what to say." And I woke up. Well, what better way to end a show than that?
That's a showstopper.
Follow your dreams.
All right, Shire Dude, tell everybody where they can find you.
Everything's at ShireDude.com.
And the Rebel Love Show has a site too, right?
Yeah, but there's a playlist for Rebel Love Show on ShireDude.com too. But you can get RebelLoveShow.com. You can check that out too.
Awesome. And Davi, you've got certainly a few.
Well, go to DaviBarker.com. Everything is listed there one way or another.
Okay. And
we have the easiest websites ever.
Yeah. Including the Freedom Fiend stuff?
Oh, you know what? Freedom Fiends is not there. You want to go to FreedomFiends.com for that show.
Yeah. So I just became a fiend.
Yeah, I'm going to have to put that on my homepage.
Yeah, I am probably going to have to do that too. So we are both, even though I'm going to be probably less frequent. But
you're both rather fiendish though.
Yes. Fiendish.
It's fiendish.
Fiendish?
Fiendish. All right, guys. Well, thank you so much for coming. This was a very different type of show, but the kind of show I wish we could do more often.
Worms.
I feel better having done it. Thanks. Great.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please help us out by leaving a positive review on iTunes. If you were angered by the show, please help us out by leaving negative reviews everywhere. If you think this is an important message for students, for parents, or for the future of intellectual freedom, please consider supporting us at schoolsucksproject.com/AV. For $6 a month, you'll get access to hundreds of additional hours of content while helping us grow and spread this message further.